Welcome to Classically Trained, a podcast where we discuss modern media that depicts the ancient Mediterranean world, its peoples, and its stories. I am Julia, your resident Greek literature person and language guy.
And I'm Allison, and I have a background in Roman archaeology and late antique studies.
And this episode, we are discussing The Thief by Megan Whalen Turner. It's a novel, a young adult novel. We are very excited. We've actually had this requested by a listener, actually multiple of our listeners, but also one of our beloved patrons, which, fun fact, we have a Patreon. Second, even funner fact, we don't, like, take requests exactly, but if you're paying us, we're much more likely to listen when you're, you ask us to cover something on the podcast. It's not a guarantee. It's just, like, you know, there's a certain incentive if you're also giving us money.
Yeah.
I would say. That said, I also want to raise as a little plug that I also made a guest appearance on a wonderful and well-known classical mythology podcast, Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, where I sat down with Liv to talk about a poet, an archaic Greek poet named Alcmaeon, who is Spartan, and his poetry is kind of fun, and Sparta is fun to talk about because it's very mysterious. And yeah, so if you are at all interested in Greek poetry, Sparta, or hearing me talk about something that isn't reception, you should go check that out. And actually go check out Let's Talk About Myths, Baby in general, because Liv is really cool and she makes a great podcast.
She does.
Yeah. So, okay, that's all of our, like, front matter. And now we can talk about The Thief. So I guess I'll do the summary and some kind of info about it, and then we can launch in.
Sounds good.
Okay. So, published in 1996, The Thief is a young adult novel, fantasy, which tells the story of a talented young thief named Eugenides, who is hired by the king of a land called Sunnis to steal a mythical gem, Hamiathes' gift. The gift is an artifact belonging ancestrally to the kingdom of Edis, a mountain territory which lies between and politically mediates between the kingdoms of Sunnis and Aetolia. According to legend, Hamiathes' gift is meant to be stolen in each generation and gifted by its stealer to the sovereign of Edis, granting them the right to rule and the title of king's thief. The king of Sunnis wants it so that he can take control of the kingdom of Edis, and he has appointed his magus the task of retrieving it, and the magus has selected Eugenides, mostly called Gen, as the thief to be doing the stealing. Gen is an Odyssean by birth and is therefore familiar with the lore surrounding the gift. He travels with the Sunnisian Magus, as well as a soldier named Pol and two young men who are named Ambiades and Sophos, to find the gift and retrieve it from a mysterious river temple which lies in the land of Aetolia. Gen is ultimately successful in retrieving the gift, despite interpersonal and also more complicated troubles along the way. And in doing so, Gen becomes entangled with the will and attention of the gods. However, to say more about the resolution of this novel would be to spoil probably the best twist in any book I've ever read, so I'm not going to say exactly what happens at the end of the novel. If we do discuss any further what happens after the retrieval of Hamiathes' gift, we will probably do so. We'll, like, put in a big spoiler warning, and we'll save all of that for the end of the episode so that you can stop listening, because, yeah, the end of this will really, it really takes you on a ride.
It really does. This book is very unreliable narrator. TM.
Yes, yes. So Gen narrates the book, and he is an extremely unreliable narrator. So, okay, so I've read this book once before this, so I'll put it to you first, Allison. Did you enjoy this book?
I did enjoy this book. I especially enjoyed it after said ending. I think that was, I was definitely more grabbed, like, the further on in the book that I got, even before said twist, I was definitely more grabbed by then. What I can't believe is that I never read this as a child.
Yeah, like, I cannot overstate the degree to which this book is as old as we were, and we were probably, like, I mean, there are other books in the series, but there was a bit of a span between The Thief and the following novels, and in fact, the last book in the series only came out, like, 2 years ago. So it's a little bit of a shock to me that neither of us, like, I only read this book for the first time a couple of years ago. I think I read it in, like, 2020, and then I read it again this year for this, obviously. I also, for the record, I really like this book. And rereading it is really fun because the twist at the end will totally, like, it's like, oh my God, it totally throws everything in the book into a new light.
Yeah.
Normally, I don't really like an unreliable narrator. I tend to find them frustrating. However, this is one of those books. There's a few books that I've encountered that are like this, that have unreliable narrators, but, like, not in a way that makes the reader feel like information is being withheld from you for fun by the characters, or, like, you're being manipulated in some way. Like, Gen is a narrator who is just, he doesn't feel the need to provide all of the context because he knows what's going on and it's fine. And he doesn't need to tell everybody everything all the time because he's a fucking criminal. Like, you know, he's a thief. It kind of checks out that he's a little cagey about stuff.
It's also worth noting when Julia says she cannot overstate how much this book is as old as we are. Literally, this book was released in 1996. And we were born in 1996.
Yes, yes, yeah. I meant that quite literally. But yeah, it's a great book. There are several other books in the series. I have not read any of them. I do have the next one, The Queen of Atolia, on my bookshelf, and I'm planning to read it next, but I haven't gotten to it yet. To Chris and Baal and Gav and all of the members of the Queen's Thief Discord server, of which I'm now a member, I promise I'm getting to them. But yeah, so, okay, so why are we talking about this book on this podcast? This didn't come up in my summary at all, because it's actually, it's like semi-relevant. So the setting of the Queen's Thief series is kind of pseudo-Greek. It is a fantasy novel, so it's not set in a real place. Obviously, Aetolia, Sunis, Edis, not real places. But it's kind of Greece. It's Greece-ish, and it's confusingly placed in time.
Yes.
So, okay, I'm curious about your impression as you went along, Allison, of, like, when you thought this was set.
My thought about when this was set was that it was sort of primarily kind of supposed to be in, like, the classical period, but with random anachronisms.
Yeah.
But that's because of some very specific things that are, I think, are specific to my context. There's a point where Gen?
Oh, I asked the Queen's Thief server about this because I was like, is there, like, a fandom agreed upon pronunciation of his name or any of the names? And literally everybody was like, there is no official pronunciation and the fandom does not agree. So I pronounce it Gen because of my knowledge of classical Greek, that I think that that is how that should be pronounced. But there's really no rules.
I'm probably just going to continue to say Gen because otherwise I'm going to have to think about it.
Yeah, that's fine. Say whatever you want. I will continue to say Gen. Just for the record, listeners, Gen, Gen, same person. Doesn't matter.
So he mentions, like, I think as he's being, like, taken out of Sunis, that there's the gate with the lion.
Yes.
Relief on it. Mm-hmm. And also the big walls. And so this was the reason that specifically made me, like, think of the classical period is because, so that's referring to the late Bronze Age city of Mycenae, which was in ancient Greece, and it's the late Bronze Age was about 3,200 years ago-ish is sort of like towards the end of the Late Bronze Age. And so the classical Greeks like knew about Mycenae, and like they, Jen mentions that the fact that the people, the like the people in his universe didn't know how the walls were built so large, and that it must have been, you know, the legend that was that it was Cyclops, like Cyclopses. In the book, they say Polyphemus, but that's not, that's just probably because it's, that's the name of a Cyclops. But there was actually, that was actually a Greek understanding in the sort of classical period that was like the myth of how these walls were built. So I think that was the one thing where my brain was sort of like immediately went to that, just because that was a very specific thing. I don't know if that made any sense.
Yes, it did. Well, there's a number of, there's like, I have four sticky notes in the first 25 pages indicating specific historical, like architectural or like city infrastructure references.
Yeah.
So the city of Sunnus, where the story begins, is like sort of Athens, but it's also not Athens because, as Allison said, there's like a reference. So the reference is on page 22 to the stone lintel with the two carved lions. However, for example, here it says the stone had been weathered by the centuries and only indistinct monster figures remained facing each other over a short pillar. So there's already a suggestion that like, yeah, I mean, obviously the Bronze Age was really far back in classical history, but like that's already pretty like, okay, that this is the ancient past that we're thinking of. Similarly, on page 4, there's a reference to a Megaron. The Megaron is a term used for like Mycenaean and also Minoan, I think, like palace complexes.
Well, so it's a very specific room in the palace complex. Like here they use it just kind of to refer to the like palace as a whole, I think. But in the Mycenaean, and I'm trying to remember the degree to which this appears in Minoan stuff. Like they use the word in Minoan context, but it looks different in the Minoan context. And it's a whole thing. It's a whole thing because Arthur Evans rebuilt the palace at Knossos based on what he thinks it should look like. So
yeah,
we're just going to put the Minoans to the side, but yeah, in the Bronze Age Greek, specifically like mainland Greek context. Yeah. The Megaron was a specific room in the palace, which was essentially like the throne room, like not exactly, but that was the sort of idea that it was like the central room in the palace. It usually had like a hearth in it. It usually had like four pillars and a hearth.
Yes. And I mean, in the book, again, page 4, it reads, once the king's home had been a true Megaron, one room with a throne and a hearth. So she's clearly like, Turner is clearly conjuring the Megaron as classical archaeologists and like other classicists know a Megaron. But again, she's very explicit in this passage about like that this was a fixture of the past, that like this classical architecture or like Bronze Age architecture is long gone. And there's also like, you know, talking about like conquest by, you know, people from far away, etc. Yeah. And then another detail on page 13, there's a mention of silver mines south of the city, which is like, okay, so which made me, when I first read this book, go, oh, so it's Athens, because Athens had silver mines at Laurion, I think. Is that what it's called?
I have no clue. I know nothing about Athenian silver mines, so this is on you, buddy.
I'm so sorry. I can't remember the name of the place, but Athens did have silver mines in its near vicinity. I think they even were to the south. So that conjures that pretty directly. And then, yeah, we get the stone lintel with the lions. And then, like, on the immediate next page, there's a reference to, quote, the long walls, which also were a thing that was in Athens, the walls from Athens. So there was a road from Athens to Piraeus, which is like the port city that was attached to Athens. And during the Peloponnesian War, the Athenians built what they referred to as the long walls, protecting that road so that people could travel unmolested from the port to the city of Athens, because Athens is not actually on the coast. It's near the coast, but it's not on the coast. However, again, quote, the long walls were later dismantled to provide building materials, etc. So we're talking about fixtures of classical, of pre-classical and classical architecture that have been destroyed or, like, reappropriated by colonial powers in years since. So there's some kind of hint sprinkled in that, like, this is not truly classical, but it's not for a while that we really get a concrete hint that we're, like, well out of the classical period, because the vibes are pretty classical for a really long time.
Yeah, well, because the thing is like, then like, there's an offhand mention that there were guns, and I was like, excuse me, what? There are guns?
Yes, so there's two incredibly abrupt, like, what feel abrupt. So, okay, there's actually a few other things before this. One of them being that people in this book wear pants. And if there's anything worth knowing about classical Athenians, it's that they didn't fucking wear pants. Because mm-hmm. pants were for the effeminate Easterners. I wish this was a joke, but they had really strong opinions about pants.
They did.
Anybody seen, like, the fact that, like, Gen talks about wearing trousers is, like, such a big red flag that this is not classical Greece. But it is one that I missed the first time. And in fact, I didn't remember this when I was reading through. I caught it this time, but I didn't catch it the first time. Actually, the first really significant anachronism is on page 93, where Gen mentions that one of his brothers is a watchmaker, which is already like, hold on a fucking minute. And Sophos, who is one of the characters who he's traveling with, says, quote, really? Can he make those new watches that are flat instead of round in the back? And I looked this up because it made me insane. Flat-backed watches were an innovation of circa 1600 CE. So we're actually well into, like, post-Renaissance here.
I mean, actually, my argument here is that this is supposed to be kind of, like, not specifically post-1600, but kind of floating around. It's supposed, my sort of interpretation is just kind of, like, floating around.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, like, we are existing in fantasy time, but the technology is more like Ottoman-era Greece than classical Greece. Admittedly, I can't attest to the broader geopolitics. We do get a reference to, quote, the Medes, who are the, like, menacing foreign empire, which is, in history, that's the Persians. But, like, Greece has had conflict with powers from the East at multiple times in its history. The Persians were, you know, one of the earliest, but, like, well, you know, the Trojans are obviously the famous mythological one, but then also, like, the Ottomans taking over from the East much later in history could as even equally inform the mold. It's just that Turner chooses to use a historicizing term because this book is so unmoored. I will also say the other major anachronism that, and when I read this book the first time, I was like, sorry, hold on, what the fuck, is that there's a gun on page 108 out of the absolute fucking wild blue yonder. And I quote, I also wondered if hidden in Pol's pack or the Magus's was a gun.
Yeah, that was really a truly, like, turn my head around moment. Like, what?
Yeah, like, especially since Gen delivers this, like, we should kind of have expected guns to be at play when there's really no concrete indication. Like, the watches are a thing, but obviously that's, like, the kind of thing where, like, maybe fantasy setting, we could have clockwork earlier than historical. But it's literally, like, nope, guns. And he refers to them as being not as accurate as crossbows, so we're obviously not talking about modern guns. We're probably talking about, like, you know, I don't know, fucking muskets or something like that. But still, or like early pistols, but still. Fucking guns?
Yeah. It really came out of left field. And I was like, okay, I guess there are guns here?
Yeah, so that's just, like, something to know that you just kind of have to know and wrangle with going forward. Oh, I did find the reference to Polyphemus. There's like a reference to the walls of the city, and yeah, that he's like a cyclops who supposedly built the old walls of the city in the king's prison, which is like, yeah, Polyphemus. Polyphemus is the name of the cyclops in the Odyssey, for anybody who doesn't know. In this book, he seems to be like a specific figure.
He's just a guy. Yeah, there's a lot of like very specific allusions, especially to like a lot of very specific like architectural and like art allusions where you'll be reading and you're like, oh, that's a specific thing. Like the lintel of the lion, like that's a very famous piece of art and architecture.
There's also in 164 when Gen is exploring. So Gen goes into the river temple alone at night to like try to find Hamiathis' gift. And there's a reference. He describes it as, he says, quote, "There didn't seem to be a temple, at least no temple like I had ever seen. There was no Naos. So of course, no pronaos, no altar, no statues of the gods or of their supplicants. No, and more important, there was no opisthotomos, no treasure room to store valuable offerings." What he's describing are the parts, the very typical standard parts of a classical Greek temple. Like, that's what a Greek temple has, is a naos, which is the, like, sanctuary. The pronaos is the part in front. Allison, correct me if I'm wrong. The altar, a statue of the god, and an opisthotomos, which is a sort of room in the back where they stored offerings, like, you know, valuable offerings.
Yes, that's correct. At one point, this was drilled into my head, but I am not an architecture person. I'm a late antique person, so the temple parts have somewhat slipped away. But yes, that's more or less accurate. It's worth it. Fun temple trivia.
Yeah.
Is that people didn't go inside temples.
Mm-hmm.
The only people who went inside temples were the, like, priests, normally. So everything that happened with sort of, like, ordinary people would happen outside of the temple. There's kind of, like, exceptions. Like, you know, like, if there's, like, a shrine to a deity where you're making an offering, like, you know, you might go up to the shrine, but, you know, sort of your, like, big classical, what you think of as a classical temple, like, regular people didn't go inside those. Like, any sort of worship would happen in front of the temple. Usually that would be, like, sacrificing an ox or whatever. I think there's a reference to that in this book where they talk about, like, I think it's the Magus maybe says that there wasn't actually a belief in sacrifices. It was just an excuse for people to, like, eat meat, essentially, to, like, go and sacrifice an ox and eat a bunch of meat.
Oh, interesting. I don't think I caught that line, but I mean, like, economically speaking, that was the function of animal sacrifice. Obviously, in ancient Greek religion, they did believe that they should sacrifice animals to the gods, but it was, in fact, a reason for everybody to get together and get to eat meat. We've talked about this in previous episodes, that, like, the Greek diet did not contain a lot of meat because meat's really expensive. But during festivals, you sacrifice a bunch of animals to the gods, and so then you get to eat meat.
Yeah. So you give some of it to the gods, and then everybody else gets some, a little bit of cow.
Yeah, and, like, shout out to Prometheus that one time for tricking Zeus into accepting the bones and the fat of the animal as the sacrifice so that humans could have the actual meat parts.
They're like, wait, we need an explanation for this. Yeah. Why did we get the good parts?
Truly. So that was the explanation. We'll circle back to Prometheus in a hot minute. I want to talk about him a bit in relation to some stuff in this book, but I want to zip through my remaining. I have a couple more, like, historical reference TM stickies, and then I'm ready to be done talking about the setting and we can talk about other stuff. So one of them, I found the reference to the Medes. So this is quite late in the book. There's a reference to the Medes. Basically, the Magus is talking about why the, like, geopolitical import of why he wants Hamiathis' gift so that he can force the Queen of Edis to marry the King of Sunnis, who he is in charge of. And he says that, Quote, you would have no way of knowing, again, but these three countries are free only by a rare combination of circumstances. The earliest invaders overran our country because they wanted us to pay them tribute. They were slowly replaced by the merchant empire, which mostly wanted our trade, and those overlords we eventually drove away. We could do that only because the merchant empire was busy fighting a greater threat elsewhere, the Medes. So, and that the Medes are trying to now take over everything everywhere, which describes this kind of succession of conquests, which obviously doesn't have a direct parallel in Greek history, but could be argued to parallel, like, what would happen if fucking, I don't know, if the Persians had won the Persian Wars, and then the Carthaginians had won the Punic Wars, and then taken over the rest of the Mediterranean, and then the Ottomans had showed up and were now taking over everybody. Like, that's like the equivalent of what seems to be, because, you know, I feel like the merchant empire has got to be equivalent to like the Venetians or the Phoenicians or somebody who had a lot of, you know, naval power or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's all fantasy, so it's just interesting.
Yeah, there is actually a map in the back of the book, but I had a hard time looking at it because I was reading it on my Kobo and I couldn't see it very well. So.
Yeah, so basically, like, Aetolia, Sunnis, and Edessa are on a kind of fat peninsula situation on one side of what's called the Middle Sea. Haha, like, it's in the middle of the land, like the Mediterranean. Anyway, and then on the other side is, like, the Medes are south. On the other side. And there's like a bunch of other stuff going on, but it's a really interesting like geopolitical setup. I feel like Turner put a lot of thought into it, which is really cool. The details are really coherent.
Yeah.
So that's fun. The other like political historical details that jumped out to me was there's one reference kind of in the middle of the book to, quote, the Eumen conspiracy, who there was like some nobleman who, quote, tried to restore the oligarchy. So, which is like, oh, so it's like almost it, which is interesting in that it implies that Sunnis at one point was ruled by an oligarchy, like Athens. Like the oligarchic coup if Athens had been a monarchy instead of a democracy at that point. Anyways, so that's also very like Athenian political history. And then there's a few like picky weird art historical details. There's a reference to a peplos, so again there's like, yes, some fashion, but it's, quote, an ancient peplos.
Well, I mean, I think the interesting thing is like the peplos is like pretty specifically associated with the archaic period, and then once you get past, yeah, the archaic period, people stop wearing peplosses.
Yes,
I did a paper I think about the peplos. There are these very famous Greek statues of young women where they're wearing the peplos, and then once you get past the archaic period, that type of statuary disappears.
It does remain a garment that you see like statues of goddesses in and stuff, though, right?
No, pretty well, like, the peplos as a form, like, pretty well disappears in statuary. Like, then you just sort of get the chiton pretty well.
Interesting. I didn't realize that it was so temporal. I thought it was more of a, I don't know what I thought. Anyway, that's neat.
Yeah.
In this case, it's identified as, quote, an ancient peplos, and it is, in fact, a goddess wearing it. When this appears, this style of clothing, this very distinctly like archaic or classical clothing, is definitely like distinctly identified with the gods. And in fact, specifically, I believe it's the goddess Moira, who is the goddess of fate.
Yes. Yeah. What is interesting is when Jen goes into the temple and meets the gods, I think the Hephaestia is wearing velvet. One of the gods is wearing velvet.
Yeah, yeah. She's wearing a quote. I have that passage open because there's also a note. There's a thing on this page that I had marked. She is wearing, quote, a robe cut from deep velvet. So that's like very anachronistic. And her clothing is also described as, yeah, so she's described as a gown. There's like various clothing on the gods that is identified as things like robes and gowns, which are not particularly timely for classical Greece. The other thing that gets mentioned in this passage where the gods are being described, which I want to talk about the gods more in a minute, the gods in this book, but when we finally meet, so Eugenides is named for the god Eugenides, who in this book is the god of thieves. He's like a semi-divine figure, or he's like a demigod raised to godhood, who is the god of thieves. And when he appears on the page, his skin is described as, quote, a deep brownish red like fired clay, like that of the ancient people who'd left their portraits on the walls of the ruins on islands in the Middle Sea, which to me really evokes the, like, ruins on Crete, like the Minoan ruins on Crete. That, like, red-brown.
There's that, and there's also the art from Akrotiri, which was a little island from the late Bronze Age. It's from the Bronze Age. And then I can't remember what part of the Bronze Age. I think it was 1600. But Akrotiri was an island, and then the island blew up. And there's no island there anymore. there were still, like, so basically there are remains.
To be clear, the island didn't, like, blow up. The island was on a volcano, which erupted.
No, the island was a volcano.
Well, yes, the island was a volcano. I mean, most of the volcano was presumably underground, but, you know.
Yeah, the volcano blew up and most of the island, you know, went with it.
Yeah. Anyway, I just wanted to clarify, because not all of our listeners would understand what you're talking about when you say the island blew up.
Sorry, did I not say that there was a volcano?
No, you didn't. And I'm sure there would have been some listener out there like, fuck, it was the aliens. It's fine. It's fine. Anyways, so yes, the art on Akrotiri with the brown skin. I know what you're talking about. And yeah, I also really like that Gen specifically describes that it's this kind of earthy brown color, like warm earthy, like brownish red, rather than like a deep, like brown black, which he attributes to a fantasy ethnic group called the Nimbians. But like, shout out to Megan Whalen Turner for being like, yeah, there's Africans. Fucking what about it? In this children's fantasy novel from 1996.
Yeah, like, it's you know, and the Nimbians sounds like, because, like, you know, yeah. like, the Nubians or whatever. Like, it's a pretty mm-hmm. clear.
This is fantasy world building, but I think what all of this is to say is that she really does not shy away from using real world details to inform and add color, as it were, to her fantasy world building. That, like, this is deeply embedded in Mediterranean history from, like, a huge span of time. But, like, there's a lot of little details here that, like, lay really nicely together. And the chronology of the history she's created follows.
Yeah. And I think the other thing, too, is, I guess, maybe why it sort of stands out is, like, we're really used to sort of, like, Western fantasy traditions, which is usually sort of like medieval fantasy, so,
which is just as ahistorical, but like,
yeah, but it's that sort of, it's that specific ahistoricity that we're used to, and not so much like a classically derived ahistoricity. I don't think that's a word, but you know what I mean.
No, I think it is, but in any case, it's fine. I think this book is. It reminds me of a thing that some people said about the TV show Our Flag Means Death when that came out, which is that it's very clear that this writer did a huge amount of research and then was like, great, and fucking threw everything she didn't want out the window. Which is fine.
Yeah.
When you're doing fantasy world building, it's fine to do that.
Yeah. I feel like it makes it richer, like the fact that she is like purposefully drawing on specific things and has these very specific details that she can use to sort of, like, build the world.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. And I really enjoy, like, rich historical world building in historical novels that do a really good job of using small, like, I remember when we did our episode on The River Through Rome with the author of that book, Nick Nicastro, and we talked a lot about how his use of, like, small details of, mundane details of everyday life really created the historical atmosphere. But this book doesn't need a historical atmosphere. It has a fantastical atmosphere. It needs the historical details to ground the mundane world building or the fantastical world building, but they don't need to be historically accurate because it's not a historical novel.
Yeah.
And it's not trying to pretend to be a historical novel. That's the thing that makes me crazy about some, like, fantasy, like, medieval fantasy that is kind of pretending to historicity in a certain way. Like, fucking Game of Thrones is, like, it tries to be kind of historical in its vibe, and, like, there's fucking nothing historically accurate about it. And it's, like, please... I haven't read enough of Game of Thrones to say that that's, like, the fault of George R. R. Martin, but I do think the fan base sometimes pretends as if it's, like, such a great parallel for the War of the Roses or whatever, and it's like, man, shut the fuck up. Like, no, it's not. It's a fantasy novel. Fantasy doesn't need to be accurately historical.
No.
It needs to be accurately historicized in its own fantastical history in order to have the atmosphere of a thing that's happening in a historical time period and in a world with a history, but that history can't and, in fact, shouldn't be real history. That's also the thing I think that makes The Lord of the Rings so good.
Yes. I find it entertaining to think about, like, Game of Thrones fans arguing that it's, like, a great parallel for War of the Roses when there's like, literally dragons.
Well, I mean, this is the thing, is, like, it's, like, I think it's supposed to be, like, yeah, it's supposed to draw on a particular period of history and the geopolitics of a particular period of history is my, like, sense.
Yeah, but it's definitely not.
But it's not, anyway. But it's got that kind of gritty, like, quote, real feel in some aspects. Basically to be like, well, it's, like, from the medieval period. Obviously people were fucking their siblings and raping children and this and that. You know, it's like, man, fuck off. That's your imagination of what history was like. That's not actually what history was like. Anyways, I have nothing wrong with historical fantasy, to be clear, but historical fantasy, good historical fantasy, is essentially a historical novel with a fantastical element and therefore is really grounded in history. Such as, for example, Helene Wecker's The Golem and the Genie, which is essentially a novel about being an immigrant in, like, 1900 New York. It just so happens that the immigrants are a golem and a genie.
Yeah, yeah.
Or, like, the Temeraire novels, which are about fighting in the Napoleonic Wars, but the person fighting is the captain of a dragon instead of the captain of a ship.
Yeah.
But, like, anyway... So that's my fucking thesis about historical fantasy and historicized fantasy, which I don't think are the same. And I think this novel is a great example of the second thing, where she's chosen a time period and a setting, and she's done all the fucking research, and then she's simply gone ahead and used only what she needed to create a cohesive world, taking inspiration from history, but not living in it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, I clearly had, like, a fucking whole rant about this just stored in my chest waiting to be unleashed.
You did have a whole... I didn't realize that there was a rant to be had, but, you know...
I was not... I also did not.
You're valid, and I support you. I support you in your Game of Thrones-related rage.
Sorry, listeners, I fucking hate Game of Thrones. I've been exposed. I want to talk about the gods and mythology in this book, and that's basically the only other thing that I really want to address. Also, I have a question for you, but I'll save that for the end.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe I'll ask you the question now so that you can, like, Google it while I fucking go pop off about mythology, which is that, Allison, this is very important and I need to know. Page 165, Gen wonders how long it takes bones to dissolve. Do you know the answer to that question?
The answer to that question is that it's very specific on the environment in which the bone is in. I did have a thought about that when I was reading it. So, for example, like, It varies like wildly. Like you can have bones that are 10,000 years old, you know, if the preservation conditions are right, or you can have bones that disintegrate pretty quickly. I'm not sure. I'm not actually sure how quickly bones go away. In the sort of environment actually they describe in the book is not actually an environment in which I think bones would decay quickly at all. That seems like a great bone preserving environment.
Yeah, I mean, they're just underwater.
Yeah, well, so waterlogged environment actually usually preserve things really well. So basically you want like an anaerobic environment. And so there's a lot of like all the sort of like, for example, ancient remains of shipwrecks are always waterlogged. And an anaerobic environment basically means that like you don't have bacteria growing in, because that's what.
Right. Because there's no air.
Yeah. Part of it's air. Part of it's, but yeah, like the main thing is that there's no way that the bacteria can take apart. I'm forgetting the word for this. What a bacteria do? Decompose. There we go. So yeah, if you're in like a sealed cavern with some water, that's a perfectly good way to keep stuff around forever and ever. Yeah, basically like any type of anaerobic environment. Sometimes these are waterlogged environments, but sometimes they're also like Egypt, like they're super, super dry environments is also another way we get like wood preservation. For example, though, if you put bones just like in the soil in your backyard, that's probably not a good place for preservation. That being said, bones do stick around for a while.
Okay.
Anyway.
So Gen being like, these bones look old as shit is not like completely out of left field, but it's also probably not like, he's not wrong to be like, these could be super, super ancient, but also they do seem to be going away over it. Because the thing is, what he's describing is a pool in an area that where there's like water moving too. So yeah. I think really what he's talking about is like erosion more than organic decomposition.
Yes.
Because, you know, so, okay, great. Well, that was a fun interlude. I don't know if I'll be able to edit that onto the end. I think I might just leave it where it is. But thank you. I was really curious about that. I was like, I'm sure Allison will have an opinion about this, even if she doesn't know the answer.
Yeah. I'm not a bone person, so I'd like to apologize to every other bone person, every bone person who is listening to this. I probably did a bad job explaining that.
Blows a kiss to osteoarchaeologists. You're stronger than me, a person who hates to look at bones.
Julie is hilarious. She can't go into anywhere where there's a mummy. She can't do it.
I really can't do it.
Which, like, fair enough, but it's kind of entertaining going to a museum and you being like, I can't go in that room. There's a mummy in there.
Yeah. Okay, we gotta get back on track. Let's talk about the gods in this book.
Yeah.
So I'll pull some passages and then we can discuss. So first of all, on page 69, nice, the Magus says to Sophos and Ambiades, fuck Ambiades, all my homies hate Ambiades.
Yeah.
Quote, Sunnas and Aetolia long ago converted to the invaders' religion, and we worship those gods in the basilica in the city, but once we all worshipped the gods of the mountain country, which is to say Edis. There is an almost infinite pantheon, which with a deity for each spring and river, mountain and forest, but there is a higher court of more powerful gods ruled by Hephaestia, goddess of fire and lightning. She governs all the gods except her mother, the earth, and her father, the sky. So there's that kind of establishing information about the Odyssean gods, that there is a pantheon, they have nature deities, they also have, essentially, they have an Olympian pantheon, which
yeah.
is very, very Greek, very classically Greek. Hephaestia, the goddess of fire and lightning, as it says, is their chief deity, excepting the earth and the sky, again, also quite Greek. And Eugenides, the god of thieves, is... He's actually a son of the earth goddess, but he's only semi-divine. So he is kind of a Prometheus figure because he steals the sky's lightning bolts. And
yeah.
He's like somewhere between a Prometheus and a Hermes because he's
yeah.
a thief and he's kind of tricksy. But he has this affiliation with mortals and the welfare of mortals in the way that Prometheus does. Interestingly, Gen relates a creation tale at the beginning of chapter 5, pages like 80 to 83, talking about the creation of Earth and like the birth of the various gods and then eventually the birth of humankind, which it's very Hesiodic. And then Sophos is like, do the people in Edis really believe that? And Gen fucking laughs in his face and is like, in Sunnis, do they really believe that the nine gods won the earth in a battle with giants and that the first god spawns godlets left and right and his wife is a shrew who's always outwitted? So it seems like the Sunnisians worship something almost also similar to an Olympian pantheon, but like almost closer to the Greek one, or like certainly that they have like a Zeus. And also they have a giantomachy, which the Odysseans don't have. So both kingdoms here have a different Olympian pantheon.
Yeah. Do you want to explain what you mean when you say Hesiodic?
Yes. Thank you. Hesiod was an...
He was about, what are we talking for Hesiod? Like 700? Yeah, he was kicking around about 2,800 years ago, 2,700 years ago.
Right. Okay, so Hesiod was a Greek poet. He was active circa 700, give or take 50 years BCE. So he's like roughly, but not exactly contemporary with the kind of date that a lot of people stick on the Homeric epics, which makes sense. He also writes hexameter poetry.
Do you want to explain what hexameter is?
Yes, dactylic hexameter is the meter of epic poetry in both Greek and Latin. In any case, both the Works and Days and the Theogony, which are the two major poems of Hesiod, are hexameter poems, or at least they're epic poems. And the Works and Days is a fucking farming manual, sort of. It's about how to be a good farmer, but like in the social sense as well as in the being good at farming sense.
I think the thing is about the Works and Days, I think it somehow also has mythology in it, even though it is also a farming poem.
It's a didactic poem that is primarily about farming, but it's also about a lot of other stuff. The Theogony, on the other hand, it describes the origins and genealogies of the gods. It's like, here's the gods, here's where they came from, here's their children.
As is evident by the name, the Theogony.
Yes, Gonos being birth. Theos being gods, the god birth poem. Yeah. So these kinds of relations of like the origins of the gods and stuff like that are, which, you know, are frequently, I mean, my impulse is always to identify them with Hesiod because he's kind of the guy who wrote the one of those that's really famous in the Greek literary tradition. There's other tellings of the births of the gods. Like, most of the Homeric hymns tell a version of the birth of the relevant god. Like, a lot of them do that, and people continued to retell them. I'm reading Callimachus this semester, who is a Hellenistic poet who wrote a bunch of hymns, and, like, his hymns also tell, like, I've only read two of them so far, but both Zeus and Apollo tell... Well, Apollo tells a story about Apollo's youth, but the hymn to Zeus tells the story of Zeus's, like, early childhood and stuff like that, like his birth and his childhood. So it's not to say that Hesiod's the only guy who ever wrote a fucking story about where the gods came from. It's just that he wrote the story of, like, where all of the gods came from in this cosmic sense and, like, how the creation of the world and stuff like that. So, and also there's a specific vibe.
Yes. That was one of the things that I was going to note about this, is that the way that the stories are told is very Hesiodic. It really, the sort of the way the language is put together is like sort of very in line with the way like Greek mythology tends to be told.
Yeah.
At least in English.
Yes.
Whether or not like that's reflective of how the ancient Greek actually sounds is another matter, but what's relevant for our purposes is that it really is told in the same way, using the sort of same like language structure as like Greek Greek myths tend to be told. And yeah, specifically like Greek myths about like where the gods come from.
Yeah. Yeah, there are these like embedded narratives where it's just the story, the myth, is like just being told outside. It's not like a character narrating. It's just like there's the narrative that is embedded into the book, which is actually really nice. There's like two or three of them throughout, which are quite fun. And actually, interestingly, Allison, and I think this is relevant to this conversation about the gods in this book, is that actually that line that you were talking about earlier about it being an excuse to kill a cow when you mm-hmm. sacrifice to the gods, it's actually Gen who says that. And it's in this passage. It's at the end of his line about how, like, do the Sinisians really believe mm-hmm. in the nine gods? And he's like, look, everybody goes to temple. Everybody likes to hear the old stories after dinner. But that doesn't mean they expect a god to show up at their door, is what he says. That's on page 84. So Gen is very dismissive of the existence of the gods. He likes the stories and he's very defensive of the versions of the stories that he knows, too. Like, the Magus basically calls him uneducated and tells him that the versions that he knows have been, quote, debased. He says many of these myths were created by great storytellers centuries ago, and it is inevitable that in the hands of common people they get debased. And Gen's like, fuck you. Which is an understandable reaction given that this is Gen's culture that we're talking about. The Magus is like a foreign scholar who thinks he knows Gen's own cultural history better than Gen does.
Yeah, and I thought that was very relevant.
Yeah.
That was definitely a I feel like poking at modern scholarship, shall we say, the sort of tendency to explain people's cultures back to them by like some guy in an ivory tower.
Yeah. And he's literally like, Gen, I bet you didn't even know that your name comes from Eugenides. And it's Gen's like, shut the fuck up. Like, he's clearly so mad, but he kind of bites his tongue a bit, because he's like, he's in a position where he doesn't want to give this guy any more ammunition. And, like, relevant to Redacted for spoilers, he really doesn't want to tell this guy anything about, like, his background. But,
yeah.
Which is also understandable because, like, he is really under the Magus's power and, you know, he's trying his best to hold his own. But he's also just like, fuck you, man. Anyway, so yes, there's a number of great mythological narratives in here, and it's really interesting that we get a lot of them from Gen, he's relating these stories of the gods, particularly of, like, kind of Eugenides, the deity, and his whole situation, and his like, rise to godhood, essentially, while at least professing not to believe in the gods. And that's the perspective that we have on the gods for, like, most of the book.
Yeah.
And then at page like 185, it's like, by the way, the gods are real. Like, and now we're gonna have them. They're gonna be on the page doing stuff. Which hits.
Yeah. No, it's a good like two-thirds of the way into the book, at least. And it's like all of a sudden, because you get, like, he's having these dreams, and you're like, okay, this maybe seems like the gods are real. And then he, like, walks into this room, and he's like, oh, these are all statues. And then he's like, wait, these are the gods. And then he just, like, leaves.
He fucking freaks out because he thinks that he's walked into, like, a room with people, and he's about to get caught stealing this fucking thing from this temple. And then he's like, okay, there's statues. And he walks into the room and it's these beautiful detailed statues of the gods. And then he's like, okay, cool, there's statues. And he approaches the statue of Hephaestia to retrieve the gift, which is like sitting on her lap, basically. And he reaches forward and, quote, I'm just going to read this because this hits. Yeah. He says, quote, this is page 186, I stepped forward until I could reach to take the stone. Then, with my hand extended, I stopped and was perfectly still as I watched the pattern of light on the velvet robe shift with the movement of a breath. So she like breathes in and he freezes, and suddenly he's in a room, not with statues, but with the living, moving gods who like speak to him and like oblige. And like he ends up involved with them, and their power ends up resting on his shoulders for a period of time, and their attention. And in fact, he's really like, as the reader, it's like, oh my God, holy shit, what the fuck? And then, and even, and Gen is also, I have a sticky note on this, page 212 says, quote, "except that I discovered that I was eager to divest myself of the god's attention as quickly as possible." So he's just as unnerved by finding out that this is all real. It's really well done.
Yeah. Yeah, this book really, really just throws some things at you. And you're like, what?
Yeah.
But like in a good way.
Yes. Yeah.
That's my official literary criticism.
This is, no, I don't think there's like anything better to say about it than like, this book really does take some turns. There's a lot that you don't know is going on for like most of the book. And even at the very end, it's kind of like, whoa. Even at the very end, you're still finding out about secrets that various people were keeping and relationships that you didn't realize existed. And it's great. I'm really looking forward to reading the rest of the series. I want to know if, like, the god stuff keeps being a thing, but I also just, like, the characters are great. Gen is a great protagonist. He's really interesting. And also the second book in the series is called The Queen of Atolia, who makes a very brief cameo. So they're in Atolia. The temple is in Atolia, and they, like, rob it, and then they have to escape. And the Queen of Atolia makes a brief appearance, and she's fucking terrifying and hot. She's hot and terrifying. Which is just great.
But there's kind of an insult there, because he's like, oh yeah, she's hot, but like she's kind of trying to imitate Hephaestia, not doing the greatest job because she's not a goddess.
Yeah, yeah. He's kind of like, yeah, she's beautiful, derogatory. Which, yeah, it's great stuff. Do you have any final impressions or petty gripes, Allison?
I mean, I don't really have any petty gripes, I don't think. It's a good book.
Yeah, I also have no petty gripes. I mean, the temporal setting stuff is like, I think it's the only turn that the book takes that I found, at least the first time I read it, that I found more jarring than I did, like, engaging and interesting. The fucking gun is, like, so out of left field.
Yeah, that I think is the closest thing that I have to a petty gripe. It's like, all of a sudden there's a gun and you're like, why is there a gun?
Yeah, which, like, when I reread it, knowing that that was kind of what we were dealing with in terms of level of technology, it checked out a lot more. But particularly if you are a classical person, like a classical Greece person, going in reading this book, I think you would have probably a similar experience to what you had, Allison, but also to what I had when I read it for the first time, where I was like, great, it's a classical setting. And then all of a sudden it's like, wait, what? It's very jarring. But if you're not a classics person, like, I don't necessarily know that you would have that assumption. If anything, you might be more likely to assume that it's more of a medieval or Renaissance setting, in which case, less of an issue.
Yeah, I think it definitely comes from, like, our specific context, maybe, that was kind of more of, like, a head-turning moment.
And, I mean, yeah, like, aside from that, there's interesting, like, rep for people of color in this book. And like, or like at least discussion and acknowledgement that like cultures of color, like dark skinned people exist, but like one of the gods is actively described as being brown skinned and stuff like that. And there's no gay people in this book, but I think there are gay people in later books in the series. So I'm blowing a kiss to Megan Whalen Turner for doing a good job with rep in her historical fantasy. It's not always.
You know what I think is really interesting about it is that it's reflecting both historical, like, the way that it's kind of pushing back on the way that people of color are often portrayed in fantasy books, cough Tolkien and his like southern hordes or whatever.
Oh, motherfucker. Yeah, the fucking raiders. Yeah.
And also sort of reflecting ancient tensions, like the fact that like Jen is like a darker skinned character, yeah. And the, you know, the people from Soonis, like especially the Magus, is interpretation is that, oh, you know, like these are like country bumpkins who don't know anything about anything. There's definitely a sense of superiority that gets kind of like the Magus gets that sense of superiority is disposed with, mm-hmm. especially once you like read the end of the book and you're like, oh, this is what's going on. Okay.
Yeah. Well, and there's a lot of like, I think this book engages in a really interesting way about with like concepts of class also that like Gen is sort of, he is leaning into stereotypes of being lowborn, but also like Sophos and the Magus, even a well-meaning character like Sophos is surprised that Gen like knows his father and like he has living siblings who have respectable careers such as watchmaker and that he's a thief. Like there's this idea of Gen as a criminal, so therefore he must be like a bastard gutter born like, you know, person who doesn't have any, and like is like the Magus assumes he's totally uneducated because he's from Edis, but also because of his class, like his apparent class, because he is a thief. And like that is a dynamic that's really stark, and it's one that's very consciously played on in the novel in a way that's really interesting and that I think doesn't always get attention. You know, you kind of get the peasant, like the fucking prince and the pauper thing going on sometimes in fantasy, where it's like royalty versus a regular peasant. But it's rare to see that whole dynamic like shifted down one step like we see it here, where it's like minor nobility and then somebody who is assumed to be from the fucking gutter, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's also, okay, I'm just gonna blow the spoiler horn here.
Okay, spoiler horn. Stop listening now if you don't want spoilers. If you are choosing to stop listening now, thank you. This was a fun episode. Goodbye. Peace out. as always, you know, do not do as the Romans did.
Et cetera, et cetera.
If you've already read this book, onwards.
Yeah, so, like, this is really, like, once you get to the end of the book, you're like, oh, Jen is part of the nobility.
Yeah, he's a fucking member of the Odyssean royal family.
Yeah.
The queen is like his cousin. He's not just a thief, he's the queen's thief.
Like, the moment of reveal when they go into the throne room and she's like, oh, it's you.
Yeah, she's literally like, oh, you fucking rat. Like, what the hell have you been up to? And he's like, hi, sis. Basically, I mean, she's his cousin, but still.
Yeah.
The Magus is like, fuck. Oh, it's so great. And really that dynamic. And of Gen being like, yeah, I'm from the gutter.
Because it's really, he does kind of want them. I feel like there's a sort of character tension there. Because he kind of, it's to his advantage for them to think he is from the gutter. But it also really pisses him off that people think that he doesn't, that he is uneducated, or that also that he is, especially with Amphit, what the hell is his name?
Ambiades.
Ambiades is, you know, like,
who's a little bitch.
Ambiades is a little fucking bitch.
Yeah.
Who assumes, like, I mean, A, that he's from the gutter, but B, that he doesn't know anything about, like, combat specifically, and then Jen just at the point just fucking yeets everybody. Yeets a bunch of soldiers, and they're like, what's happening?
Well, and the conflict between Ambiades and Gen in light of the sort of dynamic of class is so interesting, because Ambiades, like, once we know that Gen is actually highborn and like wealthy and privileged, suddenly it's like, oh shit, like, no, Ambiades was the actual poor person in that dynamic. And he's really attached to the idea of wealth, whereas Gen is kind of like, sure, I can let, like, for my own purposes, I am willing to let these people believe that I'm a wretch from the gutter. But Ambiades cannot allow people to think that he's anything but a noble, because the second that that lapses, he, like, loses everything, essentially. He has to maintain a certain stance of high classness, which involves kicking down somebody who's of lower class than him, and he struggles to do it with Gen, because Gen is actually his intellectual equal, but Ambiades doesn't think that. So they're at a significant, like, Gen actually has a significant one up on Ambiades, but he can't display it because he's pretending not to be in that position, which it adds a really interesting dynamic. And on a reread, it's, like, quite spicy. It's very fun.
I do like the fact that Jen was annoyed that the Magus didn't look surprised enough, that he had evidently had kind of figured out eventually what was going on with Gen, although it took him a little while.
Yeah, that, like, clearly, and I mean, to be fair to Gen, or to be fair to the Magus, Gen is, like, the fishiest fucking person. Like, absolutely nothing about him lines up. He's actually not a great actor. Once you know what his deal is, like, rereading this book, I was like, God, you fucking prissy little prick. Like, what the hell? He's kind of got an ego, and he's also not, like, he really, like, it grinds his gears that the others are looking down on him to that extent. Yeah. He's used to status.
Yes.
In a way that really jumps out when you reread and are like, oh, I see. But he puts it on well enough that for a new reader, it's like, oh, shit.
Yeah, because then you sort of start to get some details and you're like, what do you mean you're a professional thief? And then you get the context and it's like, oh,
yeah,
no, he is literally a professional thief.
Yeah, literally. Anyway, it's a good book. I'm glad that we talked about this. Maybe eventually we'll decide to do another one in the series, but for now, probably not.
Yeah.
Because technically this is not really in our wheelhouse. It's, like, related, but also it's far enough. I think it's good classical reception, but it's not, like, classical media.
And hence this episode, we've only been recording for less than an hour and a half. Which is about 20 minutes shorter than normal, so...
Yeah. Well, and we didn't have to fucking bitch about, like, racism, homophobia, and or sexism for an extended period of time this time, so... Shout out to Megan Whalen-Turner for that.
What a revolutionary concept.
Thanks for listening to Classically Trained. This podcast is hosted and produced by Allison Marlin and Julia Peroni on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations, and on the ancestral land of the Ho-Chunk Nation. You can listen and subscribe to this podcast on our website, classicallytrainedpod.podbean.com, and anywhere podcasts are found. If you'd like to reach us, we can be emailed at classicallytrainedpod@gmail.com, or you can leave a review. And if you'd like to support our podcast, you can find us at patreon.com/classicallytrainedpod, where we also sometimes post extras and outtakes. Our next episode will be on the 1998 film The Prince of Egypt. As always, be well, and do not, under any circumstances, do as the Romans did.